lovely to see people make an effort to be with us on Matzei Shabbat. Nice to see so many people. Very, very delighted to say a warm Shalom Aleichem and welcome to Rabbi Kellerman, who's here in London on really a very busy visit. And we're very delighted that you've managed to find the time to be with us in Kilat Aleitzion this evening. We are a very young community. And one of the things that challenges members of our community all the time is where are we going to send our children to school? That's the truth is we actually don't have much choice. Anybody who's everybody laughs knowingly. Everybody who's applied for schools, it's you send them to where you can get in. But we still have an idea of priorities and you know perhaps where we would like to send them. Rabbi Kellerman has a distinguished track record in Jewish education for several decades. And indeed a very fascinating career history as well, in terms of downhill skiing instructor to Rebbe at Neve Yerushalayim, so really ticks all sorts of boxes, and we're delighted that you're here this evening. I think the plan is that we're going to listen to you, Sesh, share some thoughts, and then if we're able to open it for questions and discussion, we'd appreciate that very much.
Wonderful.
So
okay,
very warm welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. Maybe by way of introduction, before I start, because what's about to happen is probably not what you think is about to happen. I want to learn with you a Gemara in Pesachim, and I think this Gemara in Pesachim is going to be the crucial introduction to everything that I'm going to say for the rest of the evening. It's a Talmudic passage that many of you are familiar with. It starts out as follows. Tanya Shimon Ham Suni V'Amrila Nechemi Ham Suni Hayadorish Kola Etim Shibatorah. Shimon Ham Suni was a great Torah scholar, and he believed that when God put the word et into the Torah, it was meant to include some message that was not explicit in that part of the Torah. It's a flag telling you there's another meaning there. And he went through each place in the Torah where there was an et, and he explained what that et came to include. Kevin Shigile et Hashem Elokecha Tira. When he got to the verse that said, et God you should fear, Pirush, he stopped. Why? Because he said it can't be that the Torah is telling us we should fear anything other than God. So it can't be that et is inserting some other thing there. And he said, I must be mistaken when I said that every time et appears, it is coming to add some additional thing that is not mentioned in the verse. Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, it must be that that just means fear God and nothing else. Amrlo Talmidav, his students said to him, now we'll have to understand why the students were so concerned, but the students said to him, Rebbe, Kola Etin Shedarashta, all of the et words in the Torah that up until now you attached an additional meaning to. Matehalehen, what's going to be with them? Meaning you've worked on this for a while. Amar lehem, he said to them, I'm not attached to my previous scholarship. Kishem shekibalti schar al adrisha, just as I will receive reward in the next world for all the work that I did to figure out what every one of those ets in the Torah meant when I thought that was the right thing to do. Kachani mekabel schar l'prisha, so too I will receive reward for walking away from this entire body of research now that I realized I made a mistake. Achiba Rabbi Akiva v'darish. And that's it. He took his magnum opus, he was holding it over the furnace. When Rabbi Akiva walked in and said, wait, that one line that is making you throw your entire magnum opus into the trash can, you should give second consideration to. Why? Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, et God you should fear, l'rabo Talmidei Chachamim. That comes to tell you, you should also fear Talmidei Chachamim. You should also fear Torah scholars. Rabbi Akiva saved him, and he took his magnum opus, put it back on the table, and left it in place. Okay, now, we love Rabbi Shimon Hamsuni. He was an honest person, and he thought he had made a mistake. And because he thought he made a mistake, he was willing to walk away from a previous conclusion. Now, the fact that none of you just fell off your chair means that you've never actually counted up the number of ets in the Torah. There are in the Torah 10,903 ets. If he was able, he had a drusha for each one of these. If he was able to get four drushas per page, he had written a book on etim, which was 2,700 pages long. That's the same length as the Talmud Bavli. He had written a Babylonian Talmud. And because he thought he made one mistake, he said, okay, fine, I take it back. Now, we admire him tremendously. He's an incredibly honest person. Incredibly honest. And more than honest, he's versatile. And more than versatile, he's youthful. He's not stuck. If a person wants to get to true answers in life, we have to take the attitude of Shimon HaMsuni. Now, this is exactly what life is like for our children. Because every day, starting on the day of birth, our children encounter things that are new, that require them completely rearranging their world and rearranging their mind and changing the way that they perceive everything. And we expect our children, over and over and over again, to recalculate and rebuild and admit the mistake and then say, okay, I'm going to do it that way, I'm going to see things that way, and we keep, and throughout their childhood, this is what we expect of them. And God willing, all of our children will be able to maintain this sort of intellectual honesty and flexibility and the ability to rebuild their whole worldview, right, throughout their youth. But, and I think you will agree with the statement I'm about to make, I can't demand that sort of behavior, that sort of intellectual openness, that sort of constant recalculation for my children if I'm not willing to model that myself. What's going to happen in the next few minutes is the world is going to turn upside down. I'm begging you to be open to recalculation. Be open to looking at everything a different way. Now, if I don't say something that makes sense, fine. But so far, so good. So I hope I will sound just as rational throughout the evening. But the conclusions that I'm going to draw might be out of the box. And with that, let's begin. Thank God this is not being taped. Okay, good. Here we go. Okay.
This is.
Okay, fine. What can you do? If I get it wrong, I'm willing to take it all back. The topic that I was asked to address is what happens if the ethos of the school doesn't match the ethos of my home? And finding the right school is a tremendous challenge. And finding a school that fits perfectly is a tremendous challenge. Finding the ideal school is a tremendous challenge. I'm going to recommend that perhaps the reason why I feel the school doesn't match my ethos, or perhaps the reason that I'm uncomfortable with the school options, etc., is because of mistaken assumptions. And what I want to do is I want to rethink those mistaken assumptions. Now, I am not telling you that in 30 minutes you're going to walk out of here happy with all the schools. I'm not telling you that, and I actually don't expect that. But what I do expect is that you'll walk out feeling like, okay, everything's going to be okay, despite the fact that you may not be happy with all the educational options. Or at least you'll know what to do to make sure that it's okay. Okay, and with that, we can begin. You guys are not late, you're right on time. Okay. Okay, the whole idea that I want to present to you is contained in one Talmudic passage, which I'm going to learn with you, and we're going to spend then about a half an hour unpacking this Talmudic passage. I'm going to try to extract four lessons from this particular piece of Gemara. The Gemara appears in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Hei Amud Beis, and the Gemara says as follows: Ki havu minsu Rabbi Chanina v'Rabbi Chiya. There were two Talmudic sages, Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Chiya, who had a debate. They had an argument. That means that they differed very strongly over a fundamental and significant point, because otherwise Talmudic sages don't fight. Amar lo Rabbi Chanina l'Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chanina first stated his opinion. Keep these clear because they sound a little bit alike. Rabbi Chanina is our first man. Rabbi Chanina. Rabbi Chanina said, "B'hadididi kaminsis, you're going to fight with me? Chas v'chalila, if God forbid, mishtakha Torah miYisrael, if the Torah would be forgotten from the Jews, mahadrana mipilpili, I could return the entire Torah with my brilliant teaching. I could bring the whole thing back again." Amar lo, Rabbi Chiya. Rabbi Chiya, man number two, said to Rabbi Chanina, "Padei didi kaminsis, you are going to fight with me? The Abdi Latorah de lo tishtakach miYisrael. I, Rabbi Chiya, ensured that you, Rabbi Chanina, and all of your brilliance will never be necessary. Because I, Rabbi Chiya, ensured Torah will never be forgotten from the Jews. Maya Vidna, what did I do? Azlina v'shadina kitona. I went and I planted flax. Ve'gadlina nishbi. And then, when I harvested the flax, I wove the flax into nets. V'tzayadna tave. Then I went and I trapped deer with those nets. U'machilna b'srayo liyosome. Then I took the meat of the deer, koshered it, and I fed hungry orphans. V'arichna megilta. By the way, it's interesting that he fed hungry orphans, because there's lots of hungry children who have parents, but he often decided to feed hungry orphans. By the way, the whole thing is strange up until this point. What is this man doing planting flax? Like, you know what that means to plant flax? You know how much water you have to carry back and forth to get the flax? I mean, the whole thing is crazy what he's doing. This is a rabbi. V'arichna megilta. Then I took the skin of the deer and I stretched it out and I turned it into cloth. I turned it into paper. V'kasavna chamishachum shei v'salikna lamata. Then I wrote out on five strips of this paper the five books of Moses. And I took those and I went into the city. U'makrina chamishe yinuki b'chamishe chumshe. Then I took five orphans and I sat with each orphan individually and I read each orphan one of the five books of Moses. I taught each orphan individually one of the five books. So I have five kids. The first one knows Sefer Bereishis, the second one knows Sefer Shmos, etc., all the way through. The last one knows Devarim. He still had six pieces of parchment left. Masnisan shisa yanuke shisa sidra. Then what he did was, he taught six separate kids, each one seder of the Mishnah. So now you have one kid that knows each of the five books of the Torah, and one kid that knows each seder of the Mishnah. Now, so far, all the learning has been one-on-one. Then he gathers all 11 of these orphans in this room. V'amarnalehu, and I said to the kids, "Ad hadrana, I'm going to be back soon. But while I'm away, akru ahadade, I want each of you to teach all the others what I taught you." V'asnu ahadade, they went and they taught each other. V'abdi la l'tor de lo tishtakach miYisrael. And somehow, through this crazy ritual that he had performed, from the planting of the flax, to the making of the nets, to the catching of the deer, to the feeding of the deer, to the 11 hungry kids, to taking the skin and turning it into cloth, and then writing out the Chamishah Chumshe Torah, and teaching the other six kids the Mishnah, right, and then telling them to teach each other. Through all of that, I ensured the Torah will never be forgotten. But we still have an argument. We have an argument between an incredibly talented and insightful orator, Rabbi Chanina, who was so brilliant that if he gave class, he could return the entire Torah to the Jews. And between Rabbi Chiya, who says, "I can prevent the Torah from being forgotten." What's the halacha? Who do we paskin by? Which one is more important? Hainu da'amar Rebbe. We know who's more important because Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, he said, "Kama gedolim, how great are Masachia, are the acts of Rabbi Chiya." We paskin like Rabbi Chiya. Okay. To simplify what just happened, we have two separate approaches here. One is, anytime there's a crisis in Klal Yisrael, anytime something goes wrong, we dive in and we fix things up. That's the ex post facto bidyevet approach to chinuch. That if there's a problem, kid goes off the derech, the education, right? We'll get in there and we will fix things up. Rabbi Chiya reminded his generation that there was an original system of chinuch that was given at Har Sinai. Somehow that system is illustrated here by Rabbi Chiya, and if we would practice that system, then we would never have to play cleanup. Everything would always be perfect. It's perfect education. And Rabbi Huda said, we paskin like that second opinion. So, first I want to point out that we, in this generation, have done, really, and it is a compliment for us, we have done an extraordinary job of setting up a Rabbi Chanina system. We are experts at sending ambulances to the bottom of the cliff. We are experts. We have organizations like Esha Torah and Or Sameach and Ner Le'elef and lots of others that are out there being makar of people who, through the trials of history, were disconnected from their tradition. We now, today, have literally thousands of makarvim that are working within Jewish day schools and Jewish high schools, being mechazik, giving chizuk and inspiration to those kids who are inside of our schools and are turned off. So, and there's a legitimate need for all of this. So when it comes to the ambulances at the bottom of the mountain, we're doing great. But when it comes to building the guardrails at the top, there's still some work to be done, which is why you wanted to hear this lecture tonight. Because you're concerned about the kids who may not be getting everything they could get. Now, we don't consider it a failure only when a kid leaves his religion entirely. We consider it a failure when any child doesn't fulfill 100% of his potential. And to some degree, you are concerned that the children in our system are not going to achieve 100% of their potential. So of course, the focus is therefore going to be on what do we do inside the system to ensure that that doesn't happen. I don't think things are as bad in England as they are in America, and I don't have statistics on what's happening here. But there was a giant study that was done in America, was done in New York. The study, I'll tell you exactly who conducted it. It was conducted by Yeshiva University. They went and got 2,000 respondents from modern Orthodox, mid-Orthodox, and right-wing Orthodox institutions. They were looking for anyone who had two halachically observant parents and attended Orthodox day schools across the spectrum. The graduates of these Orthodox day schools, they found, of this group of 2,000, 33.5% of them did not keep kashrus outside the home, and 8% didn't even keep kashrus inside the home. Now, we're not talking about any of their other observances. I have a whole list of observances that were coming apart, it seems. We're not talking about their relationship with God or their relationship with prayer, right, or their relationship with their Rebbe, whether they had a Rebbe, was there someone guiding them, were they disenfranchised from the community, were they connected? You can imagine what this picture must look like if a third of them are not keeping kosher. So then you can imagine what the picture must look like. I'm not saying it's like that in England, but what I am saying is that we have to think very, very, very carefully to see, are we doing everything right within the school? Within the system. I shouldn't even say the school, because the system is much bigger than the schools you'll see tonight. So I'm going to now run through four lessons that I learned about how the ideal educational system works. From Rabbi Chiya. And you'll see if I'm deriving lessons that make sense to you from that story. And if so, then all we have to do is sort of juggle our minds and decide that if we could put these four things into play, things might be a lot better. Okay, be very youthful here. Very youthful. Point number one. The Gemara here says that Rabbi Chiya personally planted the flax, and he personally made the nets, and he personally caught them. What is he doing? As a rabbi, he should be walking into a classroom teaching and not wasting his time doing all these other things. If you were going to run a school, would you have Rabbi Chiya doing all these other things before he ever gets to the classroom? Would you have thought of doing that? I would not have thought of doing that. In fact, if I saw one of my teachers in my school doing such a thing, I would have stopped him and said, that's what we have this fellow for. That's what we have this fellow for. Walk away from this process. So why did he do all of this? The Marsha makes a astonishing observation. Shekol Maisa Zeh L'Torahu. Rabbi Chiya did this because he was trying to teach all of Klal Yisrael, every Jew, a lesson about what is required for successful chinuch. Hatchila l'shem shemayim. The beginning of all successful chinuch is the people who are involved have to be doing it with no selfish interest. They have to be doing it because they love God and they love the kid. And they want the kid to have a loving relationship with his father in heaven or her father in heaven. It's got to be lishma. V'lo hayabu shum shituf davar acher. There cannot be any other motivation, the kavana, no other reason that the person is doing it. Shelo l'shem shemayim. Ki'ilu kana behema l'ora. If he would have bought an animal in order to take the skin of that animal and make it into cloth and write out the Torah, Hayabo mitzada mocher shituf davar acher. There would have been an ulterior motive on the part of the seller of the animal that legitimately he wanted to make a living selling the animal. And that, I'm going to say it in strong language, that, and it's perfectly fine for a person in business to make money. There's nothing wrong with that. We want people in business to make money. But the fact that in the chain of education, there would have been somebody who had a selfish intention, even the most kosher of selfish intentions, would have injected poison into the system. And we would not have gotten the full child's potential realized at the end, because there was someone who had a selfish intention in the process. I had the privilege of visiting a Jewish day school in New York. I visited a number of schools all around the world. This particular school took my breath away. When I walked through the classrooms and saw what was going on, I said, this is an unusual place. It's really an extraordinary school. As the principal was wrapping up his tour, he's a very humble man. He stopped in the hallway on the way out, and he just put his head down. And I could see there was something on his mind, and I said, something else you want to tell me? He said, yeah. You see that brick? The whole wall was made of bricks. I said, what brick? He said, that brick right there. You see that brick? He said, when they were constructing the building, I was supervising the construction. I was all over the construction site. And I gave very specific instructions to the contractor who built this building how I wanted the site built. And as I was walking by this place, I heard one of the rules that I had given violated. As one of the workers was putting in that brick, he said a bad word. So I had him pull the brick out, and I fired the construction company, and I brought another construction company. I told him that I fired the last one because of this mistake, and don't make another mistake like that. When they were putting in the bricks, this is not an NCSY story. I met the principal of the school who did it, and I didn't know that when I was walking through the school and thinking, this is the most amazing place. You got to love Hashem, and you got to love the kid, and that has to be the only focus. Okay, now, here's where I start to say really controversial things. There is no one who loves your children as much as you do. Or to make that klali, general, there was no one who loves children as much as their parents do. Nobody. And there's no one who's as devoted to the welfare of the children as the parents are. And there's probably no one who's as lishma, as truly sincere in what they want for their kids as the parents are. So, as parents, we can provide a very unique educational input for our children. Or another way of saying that is a parent can't be replaced. The first time I heard those words, a parent can't be replaced, I heard it from my Rebbe. My Rebbe used different language, which I have sitting in front of me, and I'm going to quote him. He said, "Achinuch u'masimu u'metelet al kol av ve'em." Chinuch is a mission which is upon every father and mother. "Ve'ein efsharut lomar." It is impossible to say, "Ani mitpater min ha'misra hazu," that I excuse myself from this mission. I am the only one on planet Earth who has the final responsibility for the chinuch of my children. Now, I can play around with a game called, what it's called, Parento and Locus, that's the name of it. I can play that game. But the reality is that I am responsible. That's why it's called Parento and Locus. It's all on my shoulders. I was the one who brought this kid into the world. When I brought the kid into the world, I took responsibility. And I can't shift that to anybody else. And I shouldn't shift it to anybody else. I can ask for help. I should be very grateful to anybody who helps me. But it's my job. It's not anybody else's job. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah were full-time mothers. They had no career that took them away from their children for a moment. And although the Yetzer has allowed us to imitate the Imaus in many regards, he stopped us from imitating the Imaus in this particular regard. And I don't believe that the makor for the way that we behave is from the Torah, the Nevi'im, or the Shas, or the Shulchan Aruch, or any Rishonim, or any Achronim. I don't believe it. I know where it's from. What do you think the percentage of from women, of Orthodox women, with children under the age of 6, what do you think the percentage of those women were that were working in 1947? Take a wild guess. So, what we know for sure is it was under 12%. I can't tell you exactly what the numbers were, but it was under 12%. You can take a wild guess what it probably was. Okay, now, what was the percentage of working mothers in the American population in 1947? The percentage of mothers with children under 6 who were working full-time in 1947, 12%. That's what was happening in the non-Jewish world. Okay, now, I don't have all the numbers in front of me. In 1999, the numbers were up to 64%. As we crossed into the 21st century, it slid over 80% in America. I believe that today, the percentage of Orthodox women who work full-time with young children is probably close to the percentage in the non-Jewish world. I believe that just as the non-Jews went in this direction, we followed right after them. By the way, we are very, very careful. We will not allow any food in our house without a heksher. Nothing. And if we're going to bring books into our house, they must have a haskama. The front door is locked tight. The back door is wide open. And the whole culture from that world flows right in, and we don't even notice it happening. But this is not the way the Jews behave throughout history. We never did what we're doing right now. It's very unusual. Notably, and this is, I think, very significant, because I hear the counter-argument, listen, you can't make it. You can't make it. So I want to point out something very interesting. In 1935, I'm only working with American statistics, I don't have statistics on, based on England, but I bet you this is not going to be too dissimilar. In 1935, the average per capita income was less than half of today's average per capita income in America. That's after adjustment for inflation over time. And the average American family in 1935 spent 80% of their income just on food, shelter, and clothing. Okay, today, we spend a much smaller percentage of our incomes on food, shelter, and clothing, and a much larger percentage of our incomes on things that, in theory, we could live without. Things that people have lived without for 100 years, right? Things that never existed until 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And we spend an enormous amount of money on those things. Yet the percentage of mothers who work today full-time is 3 times higher than it was in 1935. So in other words, in 1935, people had a lot less. And somehow, women stayed home with their kids. And today, we have so much more, and we can't afford to stay home with our kids. By the way, I do not feel comfortable saying any of this because I don't know anybody's situation. But I will confess to you my situation. I had the opportunity. There was a fluke in my life, and I was able, after I got married, to go into Colo for 1 year. And my wife and I said, let's go, let's enjoy Colo, let's learn. When that year ended, we were so happy, and we were growing by such leaps and bounds. And we were trying to decide, should we stay another year or not? At the time, I was making $400 a month. How did I survive on $400 a month? I kept selling things that I had back in America, right? I sold my stove, I sold my refrigerator, right? And in this way, we were able to keep it up, right? We used up all of our wedding money, right? Okay, we decided we wanted to stay a second year. So we stayed a second year. And as that year progressed, our standard of living dropped. But we knew that at the end of the year, right, we could stop camping and go back home and have a normal life. The problem was at the end of the year, I turned to Han and I said, you want to stay? And my wife said, I really want to stay. And I said, we've got $400 a month to play with. And she said, we'll make it work. So we stayed a third year. At the end of that third year, my wife said, one more, just go for four. Okay. So we ended up being in Colo for 4 years before the next 8 years of Colo. I was in Colo for 12 years. I survived on $400 a month for 12 years. Initially, I had a bed, but my bed broke, and I ended up sleeping on blankets on Israeli palatas, on Israeli tiles. My wife never had an oven. She never owned an oven. We had a stovetop, and everything she baked came out circular because all we had was a Wonder Pot. And we were so happy, and it was wonderful, and it was terrific. And how did we get prepared for that? I don't know. When she grew up, she used to go camping. When I grew up, I used to go camping. And somehow we said, well, this is sort of familiar, so we'll keep doing this. I wouldn't tell you that it's okay to economize if I hadn't at some point in my life tried it. But I tried it, and we had 5 kids living in 60 meters with 1 bathroom, and it was Gan Eden. It was tricky. We had to organize things. No child had his own bed. It was always 2 children per bed. And the kids loved it because they learned not to grab all the blankets and take them for yourself. So I'm not telling you something that I haven't tried. It can be done that I dropped below the level that I grew up with. By the way, I grew up in Beverly Hills. That was my neighborhood. Beverly Hills, for those of you who don't know, is not one of the poor neighborhoods in Los Angeles. Yeah, I had a silver spoon. I had everything I always needed, right? But there were things that were important. My wife was voted one of the top 20 artists in America under the age of 25 when we got married. Her work is extraordinarily valuable. She could have supported me easily in Colo all 12 years. And we made a decision that if we cannot have one full-time parent with these kids, then the whole Colo business is not worth it. And my wife did not paint for 20 years. We thought that she lost it. By the way, after 20 years of doing what she did, when she picked up the paintbrush again, her work was 1,000 times deeper than it had ever been. She built her art by building herself, and she didn't lose out on a thing. And Baruch Hashem, we have beautiful from children and beautiful from grandchildren, and I think I'm probably in a minority when I say that I worked in Kiruv for 20 years, and every single one of my kids was on the derech the entire time, and it still is. That's not so common. But there was a full-time mommy there. Point number one, if I want to improve my child's chinuch, and everybody here does, then focus on the heart of the matter. School's important, they're important. Let's focus on the heart of the matter. You can accomplish an enormous amount, regardless of what happens in the school, enormous amount. And the school, I won't say it's batel, it's almost batel. It's almost butthole compared to what you can do at home if you put your mind to it. If you say, I'm going to do everything right, you can overwhelm other influences in the child's life. If you don't put in that sort of an effort, God forbid, then you hand an enormous amount of influence over to the school. But if you decide you want to take the reins, you can have an enormous impact on your children. My wife was discussing with a bunch of rabbanim tonight the whole issue of media and smartphones and internet and all this kind of stuff. And the rabbanim were saying to her, you have to keep the kids away from it, and you have to ban it from them, you have to take it away, and right, and it's destructive. And they went on and on and on speaking about that. And at a certain point, my wife just exploded. And she said, you're only talking about Sur Meirah. What about Asay Tov? If your kids are so busy having a fun time with you, going out and going rollerblading or doing ice skating, or you guys go biking together, or you go, in Israel, we go abseiling together, right? Like, whatever the thing is, right? Give them dance. Right? If you would fill their lives and show them how much fun it is to be off of the phone, so then you're not going to have to worry about taking the phones away from them. And the objection was that we don't have time for that kind of stuff. If you want to, you can take an enormous amount of control over your child's life, if you want to. Point number one. Point number two. We have 4 points. Rabbi Chiya fed the meat to the orphans. Why does the Gemara stress that he fed it to orphans? So, Rabbi Chiya was the paradigm of a teacher. And what we learn here is a teacher's job is to take over where the parents leave off. As long as there were parents, he didn't feel that was his job. But when there are orphans, then Rabbi Chiya has to jump in there and he has to take care of things. The parents, I'm sure, are giving a good chinuch, he thought. But where there's no parents, that's where I have to do something. So he took care of kids with no parents. Now, what does that mean when we do exist? So, when I have to confess to you, I don't know if there's any hanhala of schools here or teachers in schools. If there are hanhala of schools or teachers in schools, I just want to say that you should know that I'm only speaking to the hanhala and teachers now. The parents have no responsibility for the chinuch of their children. All the responsibility for the chinuch of the children falls on the hanhala and the teachers. Okay, now, for the parents in the room, this is your job. It's not their job. And therefore, anything that you want your kids to know, teach them. Now, it could be because I was out there in the wild, wild west in Israel, this was very clear to my wife and I. There were things that we wanted our kids to know that there was no way that these kids were ever going to pick up in an Israeli cheder. And we sent them to an Israeli cheder because we wanted to get the very, very finest Jewish education they could get. But there were other things I wanted them to know. And I taught them, and my wife taught them. And our kids, before school hours, after school hours, were home tutored. And when the academic load, as they got older, and the academic load got too heavy, and they couldn't learn from us and keep going in the cheder, So then our kids just started to get sick now and then. And we would keep them home and I would continue to teach them, right? Not every day, not all the time, usually in the afternoons, late in the afternoons, I would pull them back, but they had to have time to play also. So I'd bring them home an hour early now and then, and I would continue to tutor them. My wife tutored them, I tutored them. By the way, sometimes there were areas where my wife and I were not competent to tutor, and then we hired a professional tutor to come in and teach our kids, right? And while my wife was making cookies for the kids, the tutor was sitting and teaching them. So the key is that we took responsibility. We never said, well, the school's not doing it, so it's their fault, and now the cheder has to start teaching pre-calculus. That was not going to happen. I was realistic. That was not going to happen. And I don't say, well, those chadarim are terrible because they didn't teach pre-calculus. They never said they were going to teach pre-calculus, right? If they did, I wouldn't let them. Yeah, but they never said they were going to do that. And that's something I wanted for my kids, so I took responsibility for that. I taught them. It's a tremendous responsibility, but it's a tremendous schus. And I'll go a step further. Personal confession. The most important things that I ever taught to my children, I did not teach sitting over a pre-calculus book. The most important things I ever taught to my children, I taught to them at bedtime. Bedtime in the Kellerman home was not 20 minutes. Bedtime in the Kellerman home was 90 minutes. I'm talking about 90 minutes per kid. Thank God we were able to overlap a lot. But it was 90 minutes per kid. Why? Because it's a time when the children were very emotionally vulnerable. They were very open, right? It was a calm time. And I used to lay down in bed with them. And I used to read them books and talk about the lessons in the books. And my wife would lay down with them and read the books and talk about the lessons in the books. And there was all sorts of very informal, wonderful chinuch that took place at bedtime. And it's so easy to do, and the kids love it. I mean, you want to teach your kids great mitos at bedtime? Read them Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And it helps a lot getting into bed too, because you leave off right where there's a dramatic moment about to happen. You say, okay, if you're in bed on time tomorrow, we'll continue this. So wake up time and bedtime is really wonderful. And it doesn't have to be a pressured thing, but like, you got to get into bed because I got to leave. We're like, well, I'm busy right now. It's a wonderful time. That's chinuch time. A second example I was going to give. My Rebbe was a Mashkiach at a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael called Ber Yaakov for many years. They cranked out amazing students there, just amazing. And then one day, Volba resigned. So I met him after he had left Ber Yaakov. And seeing the trail of godless that came out of that school, the great people, the midos, like just spectacular, I couldn't understand. I said to him, Rebbe, why did you leave? Why did you leave Ber Yaakov? What happened? And he told me the story. Every morning, he said, I was the one who woke up the boys in Ber Yaakov. There were no parents in Ber Yaakov. It was a boarding school. So every morning, I went to wake up the boys. He wasn't going to have some other boy wake up all the other boys. He's the parent there. So he went and woke up every single boy. How did he wake up each boy? You're not going to believe what I'm going to tell you. Go ask anyone who was at Ber Yaakov. They all tell the same story. I've heard it more than a dozen times. And Revolba told it to me personally. Revolba said he would go to each boy and he would wake him up singing him a tehillah, something from Tehillim, a tehillah that was appropriate for him. Now, I don't know how many boys there were in Ber Yaakov, but there was more than five. And he woke them all up every morning, and every boy got his own tehillah. Do I wake my kids up that way? That's an amazing thing. Okay, I can't sing, but nevertheless, yeah. Look at how he felt about his child, so to speak, his children. The last thing I was going to say in this regard is that there were times after I had left Kollel, when I had to travel. I taught an enormous amount overseas while I was in Israel. I spoke to Revolba about it before I did it. And Revolba said, I was very concerned about the chinuch of my children. And Revolba said, no, don't be concerned. Your children will be better off if you leave. He didn't mean it that way. He said, every time you go on a trip, take one of your children with you. And he said, they will be living with you 24 hours a day, watching exactly how you conduct yourself. watching how you make brachas, watching how you go to shacharis, right? Watching when you walk through a place where you need to guard your eyes, watching exactly how you behave in every single situation. And you'll be talking on the train and on the bus and on the planes, and there'll be enormous amount of chinuch taking place. I said, but they're going to miss out on school during the 2 weeks that I have them out, 2 weeks at a time sometimes, a week, 2 weeks. He said, they'll learn far more from you than they will in school. Take them with you. What was with the schools? How did they permit this? Whatever, our kids were sick a lot. Point number two was that the job of the teacher only begins where the parents leave off, and you can draw that line wherever you want. That's completely under your control. Point number three. Rabbi Chanin is famous for lecturing. Rabbi Chanina was famous for lecturing in front of the students. Rabbi Chanina was one who gave the big classes and was an amazing speaker. We don't have any record of Rav Chia addressing a group of students except when he was saying goodbye and I'll be back in a few weeks. We don't have any sign of him ever teaching the students in a group. So why is it that the model of the ideal education in the Gemara is one-on-one? What was that? He couldn't have taught two students at a time. He could have doubled the amount of students who were influenced by him. Why do you have to teach one student at a time? It's bizarre, no? It's bizarre. So I had a theory, and I, as those of you who know my background and my work, I love research. I'm a research fanatic. And so I researched to see if my theory was true. And here's what I found. The Tennessee Student-Teacher Achievement Ratio Project is arguably the largest, best-designed field experiment ever conducted on the effect of class size. It began in the mid-1980s. It involved 79 schools, 328 classrooms, and about 6,300 students. These students were tracked from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. This is a giant study. The children were randomly divided up into three types of classrooms. One is the standard classroom. A standard classroom has one certified teacher and more than 20 students. The second type of classroom, the supplemented classes, have one teacher and one full-time non-certified teacher's aide, and also 20 or more students. And three, there were small classes. This is only one teacher, no aide, but the class was limited to 15 students. So they dropped it from over 20 to down to 15. Okay. Every year, the students were given the Stanford Achievement Test. It's a battery which gets separate achievement scores for reading, word study skills, mathematics, a whole range of things. Okay. Listen to the results. There were no significant differences in academic achievement between the students in standard classes and those in supplemented classes. Once you had over 20 students, it didn't make a difference if there was one teacher or two teachers. It didn't make any difference whatsoever. The scores were the same. However, in the smaller classes, there were markedly higher levels of achievement. And the extra gains associated with long-term exposure to small classes were greater the longer the students were exposed to those small classes. Okay, what are the numbers? Already, by eighth grade, the kids in the small classes were 4.1 months ahead in reading, on average, 3.4 months ahead in mathematics, on average, 4.3 months ahead in science, on average, 4.8 months ahead in social science, on average. That means there were kids who were 6 months ahead, or 9 months ahead. And all we did was bring it down to a small group of 15. Imagine if we brought it down to a group of 10, or 5. Or one. Imagine what that would do. More, second finding. Students from smaller classes also had higher GPAs, lower flunking and dropout rates, and once they entered high school, more small class students opted to learn foreign languages, took advanced level courses, were found to be in the top 25% of their classes, graduated from high school, and took ACT and SAT college entrance exams. Moreover, the results demonstrated that children with learning disabilities were even more dramatically affected by small or large class size than mainstream students. So I have a theory about what's going on here. I'm going out on a limb. I have no proof of what I'm about to say. I heard this from my Rebbe, but I can't prove it scientifically. I think that the reason that as the classes get smaller, the level of achievement goes up so fast is because the student's ability to achieve is a function of how much he loves the teacher and how much he feels the teacher loves him. And that is the factor which is most affected as you make class size smaller or larger. If you've only got one person sitting there and you're totally devoted to that one person, then you know what that would feel like. The material is a completely different material. I want to learn the material. I want to learn it because of my Rebbe who's sitting across from me. It's the relationship which carries it. One last point, the fourth point, and then I'll stop and take questions. I probably already went way over time, but I just want to get in one more point, which is not long. The Gemara says that Rabbi Chiya did not teach any student Kol HaTorah Kulo. Every student was taught a small piece of the puzzle, and then the students were taught to teach each other. I believe that that one point, more than any other of the things that Rabbi Chiya did, was what made him feel the Torah would never be forgotten from the Jews. Why? Because if the Torah goes into the child separate from the lesson that that child is responsible for taking care of all of his Jewish brothers and sisters, it's possible he'll get the Torah, but he won't get that lesson that he's responsible for every other Jew. But if the two go in together, if at the time when I'm learning Torah, I know I've got to learn this. I've got to learn this because there's 10 other people in this room who are counting on me, and I've got to be able to give it over to them as soon as Rabbi Chiya walks out the door. If my whole learning process is for Klal Yisrael, so then when I get older, I'm not going to forget about the rest of Klal Yisrael. I will take care of all the rest of Klal Yisrael because that's what my learning was always about. I always learned in order to give it over to everybody else. And in that way, we would ensure the Torah would never be forgotten, because how could there ever be a Jew who wouldn't have access to Torah when there's so many of us who know things who could be teaching that Jew? It would be impossible. There would be no such concept as Kiruv. The only reason Kiruv exists is because there were a Jew who got ignored. But how is it possible a Jew got ignored? It's got to be that all the from Jews that were around, for some reason, didn't learn Bechavrusa with that Jew. Today, I think probably the most successful Kiruv program on planet Earth is a quiet, understated, non-Kiruv program called Partners in Torah, where from people get a non-religious partner or a less religious partner, and they learn together. I was just in Detroit 5 days ago. In Detroit, a tiny little city in America with a small Jewish population, every Tuesday night, they have between 250 and 500 quote-unquote non-religious Jews who come to sit across from their chavrusas, who are 250 to 500 religious Jews. And this has been going on for 20-something years. And it's hot. Everybody loves it. The secular Jews love it. The religious Jews love it. They're good friends, right? By the way, imagine what this would do for the community also, just if there were no barriers between all of these different sects within Judaism. Imagine what that would do if everyone was learning with each other and loved each other like this. And that's what Rabbi Chiya was creating. Learn so that you can take care of the rest of Klal Yisrael. By the way, that little trick that the teacher doesn't have to teach all the information to the students, that you could put into a classroom in a moment. I mean, that's nothing. That's child's play. And look what that would do to transform the picture. So, to summarize, we learned four lessons, and I'll take questions when I summarize these. Number one, lishma and love for the child counts, and no one is as lishma or loves your child as much as you do. Don't let others do what you could do for your child. Point number two, Parenting isn't a 9-to-5 or a 5-to-9 job. If you decide to have children or step into a classroom, you've committed your resources and all waking hours to helping every child achieve their potential. Point number 3. It's impossible to bring forth 100% of a child's potential in a group setting. Each child must have private time. Point number 4. We have to teach our children they exist for the sake of the call. We must pray that they spend their lives living out that value. And we have to demonstrate that with our own behavior. We have to demonstrate that very same lesson. Okay, that's about as controversial as I can be for one night.
I'm going to thank you at this stage for those observations and those ideas that you've shared with us. You're certainly right, you were controversial in many ways. And I think one of your opening statements was very important. You said it was important we're open-minded, willing to listen to new things. Many of the things you said were very different to what we usually speak about here in Kirat HaLeitzion. I think it's valuable for us sometimes to have the opportunity to hear other takes on things. And I think it's important for us to be able to, you know, ponder the points that you've raised and to try and internalise them and realise that sometimes there's a lot to be gained from points of view that we're not naturally and regularly exposed to. So I do thank you for that. I'm going to exercise Chairman's prerogative and challenge you on one point that I thought was interesting, and that is the role of the mother in the home and working mothers. And just listening to your statistics, thinking back to the 1960s, where very few mothers were working, certainly not full-time, and comparing it with today, when most mothers are working, if not full-time, but at least part-time, I'm not sure that the results of the Jewish family were that much more successful in the 1960s than in the year 2010. If we think about all the people who've grown up in non-religious homes, perhaps whose grandparents were religious and their mothers were at home with them. So I'm not convinced that in actual fact there's necessarily a correlation between between the two in that regard. We'll open the floor to questions in just a moment. I'd like specifically to, if we can focus a little bit on the title that we were thinking about for this evening in terms of a dissonance between the home and the school. Can you share with us some thoughts on how parents can effectively teach a message at home which is at odds with the hashkafa of the school without undermining the authority of the school? So, you know, and we were very delighted, I'm sure, and impressed to hear that all the Kellerman children and grandchildren that's are following Masoret Yisrael Saba in such a successful way. But, you know, let's take for an example, many people in our community, are committed to the Zionist ideal. Many of the more Torani schools in London have an ambivalent attitude towards Tzionut and Yom HaAtzmaut and such things. So people perhaps in Kirat HaLeitzion might want to promote that ideal at home without undermining the authority of the school, which doesn't promote that. Can you share with us perhaps some thoughts on that in terms of, you must have experienced with your own children, pulling them out of school because they were ill to teach them things that they're not being taught in school, but presumably not wanting to undermine the authority of the Rebbeim at school who didn't hold with pre-calculus.
Excellent. Okay, so one step at a time. The first step is that I agree with the Rav that there may have been many factors in the 1960s that may have made it difficult for kids to flourish Jewishly. I don't know the statistics, but that's certainly possible. I didn't mean to say that because there were fewer working mothers in the 1960s that the kids came out better. That's not what I meant to say. What I meant to say was that the Jewish trend of women going to work wasn't generated by the Gemara. It represents assimilation, that we were following exactly what was happening in the non-Jewish world. That's the only point that I meant to make. Yeah.
Can I mean, we've all been brought up on stories of the Chafetz Chaim's wife running the shop.
That's a beautiful story. I like that. Let's run with that for a minute. Chofetz Chaim's, this is such an important story because we do focus on that 24-month period where she ran a shop until she closed it. From the time that I heard this from Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandson, from the time that the Chofetz Chaim's wife closed that shop, there has not been a single Gadol's wife who worked. It wasn't done. The Gadolim didn't do it. The Gadolim's wives were home. They took care of their children. So,
Rabbi?
Yes?
Sorry. How does one, if one is saying that we're living at a lower level, now everybody around you, live in London, I'm from Manchester, which is a lower level, I mean, how do your kids adapt? Was one living in Israel when you were living $400 a month?
Excellent. So wait, let me do ethos, Yom Ha'atzmaut, and then come back to this question. This is important.
Yeah. Get your kids to be like, they don't want to be deprived of what everyone else around them.
Excellent.
That's how do you manage that?
So I'm going to deal with that now. Okay, first. ethos and Yom Ha'atzmaut. All of my kids went to Haredi Chadarim. So you know what Yom Ha'atzmaut looks like in a Haredi Cheder. My wife and I are Zionists, and Yom Ha'atzmaut is something for us, and we can see the fireworks from our porch, and it was a big deal for us. And so on Yom Ha'atzmaut, we would take all the kids up to the roof and we would watch the fireworks. There was no conflict with the Cheder whatsoever because we just never talked about it with the Cheder. And there was no issue of having fireworks on that day because other people were having fireworks, not my Cheder. And as far as they knew, my kids were steigen over a Gemara. Yeah? And it's not something that I got involved with them. Why? Because I have no desire whatsoever to change the Cheder. The Cheder never promised me that they were going to be a Zionistic institution. So I don't expect that of them. But anything I want my kids to learn, I'll teach them. If you want your kids to be Zionists, now again, I don't know exactly what Zionism is. The way that I always understood Zionism is that we support the state, we support the country, we support the defense, we put our bodies on the line. If you want your children to be Zionists, get up and get on a plane and come to Israel. Now, it could be that's not Zionism, but I always thought that's Zionism. And your children will get it in their blood.
You've come to the right shul to say that.
Fine. So no one is stopping you from making your kids into flag-waving Zionists. Get on a plane. If you tell your kid, I'm a Zionist, and I give as much of my money every year to the state of Israel as Israeli citizens do, you know what our tax rates are, yeah? That's impressive. If you tell your children that I give about 50 to 60% of my money away every year, 50 to 60% of what I earn, I give away to the state of Israel, that will make a huge impression upon them. That's Zionism, yeah? If you tell your kids that Zionism is Yom Ha'atzmaut, you're not going to end up with Zionists. You're going to need to go a lot farther than that. Zionism is a lot bigger than a holiday. And it's Mesiras Nefesh, that you put your body on the line for the country. That's what it is. Your body, your money, whatever you're capable of giving. So I don't see a problem. And if you do decide that you want to stay in London, so then just teach your kids that they should, when they get old enough, move to Israel. Because that's Zionism. Zionism, you get up and you move to Israel. That's what it is. So teach that to your kids. And again, I can't imagine what the situation is. If you tell your children that when you get older, you should get up, leave us, and go to Israel. Will that cause a problem with the Cheder? You'll get thrown out for saying that to them? I can't imagine. I mean, after all, there is a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael also. You know, like it's... I think it's smalkite. It's like, forget about that. Don't make a whole machlokes with a school over such a thing. Just teach your kids your values and enough. Don't have your kid come to school that day wearing an Israeli flag. That would be silly. But I didn't make a fight with Chadarim. Why did I make a fight? I just taught my kids. And I took control over my kids' education. This is what I'm saying. Whatever you want your kids to know, teach them. You potentially have a much louder voice than the school if you grab it. Yeah. And again, the loudest voice is get up and leave. You want to hear something amazing? I'll tell you two things that are shocking. One more shocking than the next. I'll start with the least shocking. In Toronto right now, there's something happening called financial aliyah. Now, if this isn't a hint of Mashiach coming, then, because we always say, if you want to end up with a big fortune in Eretz Yisrael, I'm saying, if you want to end up in Eretz Yisrael with a small fortune, go with a big fortune, yeah? Eretz Yisrael was not the place. Today, the schools are kimat free. the economy is booming. I think it's like the fifth most powerful economy in the world today. Yeah, the cities are gorgeous. The security is better than it's been in 20 years. Like, it's spectacular. So the people in Toronto are looking at the future and they're saying, I got 4 kids, 8 kids, 10 kids. To buy a home in Toronto costs over $1 million. We can't afford day school tuition. The kids are getting on planes with their young families and they're coming to Israel because they can't afford to live in Toronto anymore. That is going to be happening all over the world, right? There are going to be people all over the world who can't afford the life in Lawrence, New York, or Los Angeles, California, right? Or perhaps Golders Green. It could be that we just can't afford to live in these places anymore. And if you would move, not to David's Citadel in Jerusalem, but if you would come and you would move into the center of the country, so or the south, you can get a mansion for free. It's so cheap there. So the first point I want to note is that there's a new trend happening, and I believe that what we're going to see is enormous numbers of Jews leaving Chutz La'aretz and going to Eretz Yisrael for financial reasons. Point number two. A close friend of mine, I actually run with him the track every day, is a sociologist. He's a professor at Rutgers, and he's written a large number of sociology books on Jewish nations. His name is Chaim Waxman, Dr. Chaim Waxman. Dr. Waxman says that if current trends hold, we're not looking for any increase, but if current trends hold, then more than half of identifiable Jewry will be living in Eretz Yisrael in 20 years. Okay. Do you understand the implications of that? The halachic implications of that. The majority of Jews back in Eretz Yisrael again. You're talking about the ability to restart smicha. You're talking about setting up potentially a Sanhedrin. You're talking about theoretically people being able, we have paradum every now and then, being able to bring korbanos. Like crazy, crazy things that were never possible in 2,000 years could be possible within 20 years. Now, right now what I'm saying, it's shocking. When I say that, I find it shocking, right? You're going to think, Kelman is out of this world. Go check the numbers. Where are you going to be when that happens? I mean, this is crazy what's going on. So, I mean, very seriously, teach your kids to be Zionists and put them on a plane and send them over there. Tell them, go off to yeshiva and don't come back. Yeah. Okay, now, that was... okay, now, you had to ask the question. Let me deal with your question. Lower economic status.
Basically, around one in London, there's lots of people living on a very high economic level. If your children are living on a lower economic level, how do you manage that with children in school? Because obviously you're mixing with the very rich, you're mixing with everybody. It's not like in the non-Jewish world where it's very divided.
Right.
Then how do you manage that with the children? If you're going to turn around and say, I want to live on a lower level, I want to stay, your mum's going to stay at home.
Excellent. So you're 100% correct.
How does that work?
You're 100% correct, and it could be damaging. And if children grow up, it could be damaging. And if children grow up feeling that they're the poorest of all the children, even if you gave them a great experience at home, they might be resentful of that one fact. Mm. And that could backfire.
So how does one manage that? If you say, I'm not working, because if one of us stopped working, that would be lowering of our economic situation at home. Just because of the rent in London is so high that we could not manage without me working. So how would you manage? How could you possibly do that? No, so how do you explain to one's children that, hang on, everyone around you is...
Yes.
Living on this luxury planet.
So, a few things. Point number one, I don't want to keep coming back to this theme, but it's much better in Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah,
that's
true.
In Eretz Yisrael, the standard of living for everybody is a lot lower than here. And so, people just live on less.
Right.
We're
so
not
that's
like
much easier.
It's much easier. So, that's always an option, but let's go back to London. I don't know what it's like in the school. If you're talking about your children being a tiny minority in a school where the vast majority of people have a lot more, that is going to be hard on the kids. If By the way, that could happen even with mom working full-time. Mom and dad working full-time, it could happen. If it was a situation of you're doing everything you possibly could do to keep your head above water, including mom working full-time and dad working full-time, and the kids are still the poorest in the school, so I have a strategy that I would recommend, which is you have to give your children the impression that they're getting things that nobody else is getting. So, for example, when our kids were growing up, they were young. My youngest at the time was 3. That means we had a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 9-year-old, and an 11-year-old. And we were not rich. We were very poor. We were a lot more poor than the other people around us, but our kids were poor. We kept looking for opportunities to make our kids feel like they had something special. So one of the things that we used to do was, this is an example, for a year, we kept our kids home from school, all of them, every single Friday for a year. What did we do? Every Friday morning, we used to take them down to the Dead Sea. We would leave at 3 a.m. We would go down to the Dead Sea. We would hike up to the top of the mountain, down by the Dead Sea, Daven Shachris, have a really nice breakfast, and this was Friday activity. And then we'd throw ropes over the cliff and abseil the whole day. My wife would make Shabbos on Thursday night, and we'd get home at 2 and 3 p.m. Shabbos would be ready, the kids would come in, we'd wash off all the mud, and right, Shabbos would start. That was Fridays in our house. None of their friends had something like that. Now, the total investment was we had to buy the ropes and we had to figure out how to do this thing. But after that, the cost was very, very low, and our kids felt like they had this secret, this amazing other life that they were leading on Fridays that was just spectacular. And the kids in school didn't learn anything on Fridays anyway. They just got their Parsha sheets. So it was okay. I'm not recommending that you go abseiling in London. What I'm recommending is that you try to find some way. Again, if you're doing everything you can possibly do and your kids are still the poorest kids, give your kids the feeling that they're very, very special. And it could be even just that, I don't know, you bake cookies with them and they love that, or right, you give them some sort of love or some sort of attention or some sort of activity that no one else gets. And they feel that, you know, I know I'm special and that I'm having a special childhood, better than everybody else. Okay, now, you're asking another question, which is that what happens if I could stop working, but if I stopped working, then I would take my kids from not being the poorest to being the poorest, and I'm now going to put them in a new class. So you have to speak to your Rav. I can't answer the shayla. Why? It depends what really is happening in the rest of school and how much damage it's going to do and how big the gap is going to be, and how do kids in London react when there's such a gap? Unfortunately, you're dealing with a Yankee here. Like, I have no clue it would be irresponsible for me to paskin. If your Rav says it's educational sakana to do that to your children, then finished. You have to keep working. There's no option. And maybe your Rav will say, okay, listen, you can go to 3/4 time and your kids will still be okay. So that might be a possibility.
We were looking for a 9 o'clock finish, so we're going to take one more question, and then we'll wind up. That's Miriam.
Thank you much. I'm concerned that the analysis of working mothers overlooks the fact that a lot of working mothers don't work because they have to, they work because they want to, certainly in the modern Orthodox community, which they're surely part of. So that concerns me, and I think the reason why women in the modern Orthodox community are working is because they're highly educated, highly intellectual, and highly competent and highly skilled. They're not doing it because they have to, they're doing it because they want to. You might call that assimilation. I think a lot of people in this room call that orthodoxy. So I think that's a starting
point for people who are
initial.
In
terms of whether any gadol has ever had a working wife, where you're standing right now, Dr. Topper Lichtenstein spoke 2 weeks ago about her career in social
work. You're correct, I'm wrong.
I think my question, and I'm not just having a rant, my question is it your view that in order to have a full-time parent, which you said it's important to have, that parenting is a full-time job. Is it your view that there is that responsibility falls more on the mother rather than the father?
Oh, that's just a question. You're talking having the man stay home full time.
Yeah.
No, have your husband stay home full time. Fine, I don't care. Yeah, I don't care. I do want to address the issue that you raise. It's very important. I agree with everything you said. I'm not going to contradict anything you said. I'm going to add another dimension. I teach parenting classes in Jerusalem. And the people who are coming to those parenting classes are highly intelligent people. Many with advanced degrees. I mean, not what we call a Torah Rishon. We're talking about master's degrees, PhDs, highly intelligent individuals. They come to me with really complicated problems, parenting situations. And I show them how to unravel the situation, how to analyze it, and how to resolve the issue. And many of these classes are ongoing, and the parents say, they say it worked, and they come back and they say, okay, now I got another one. Okay, now. The reason that sometimes I'm able to help them is because I spent 25 years studying a really complex, really sophisticated wisdom called chinuch. It is incredibly complex to try to take a potential human being and make them a real human being. Very complex. So I find it funny sometimes when someone says that the reason that I need to leave my kids is I'm looking for intellectual stimulation. There is nothing that I've ever experienced. I studied at UCLA and Harvard. There's nothing that I've ever experienced which is more complex than taking a potential human being and bringing out all of it and getting 100% of that potential out onto the table. It's beyond. So if what someone's looking for is intellectual stimulation, complexity, right, a sophisticated career, then try, and they're interested in taking care of Klal Yisrael, then try taking one or two or five or 10 kids and bring out all of their potential. You're not selling out in terms of your career. You're selling out in terms of your salary, because you're not going to get paid very much as a full-time mother or father. But you're not selling out by becoming a dumb housewife or husband wife, right? You're not selling out in that way. You're approaching something which is incredibly complicated. So I want to give a defense that raising kids is not for dumb people. It's for people who are really looking for sophistication. But I'm not arguing with anything that you said, and everything you said I agree with. And I stand corrected about Dr. Lichtenstein. Yes, thank you.
Guys, thank you so much for joining us. Very, very grateful to you. It's been wonderful to hear your insights, your interpretation of the Talmudic passage, and hearing your thoughts on the subject of education. I know you've got an immensely busy schedule whilst you're here in London, so we're very grateful that you've had the opportunity, and we've had the opportunity, to be together on a Motzei Shabbat. I want to thank Razel for facilitating this evening, and Pages also for bringing Rabbi Kellerman over, and we wish everybody Shavua Tov. Thank you for joining us, and thank you once again for being here. Thank you.